Hi, my name is Amantha Imber, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media, and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com. All right. My guest this week is Dr. Amantha Imber, founder of Inventium, author of Time Lies out on July 5th, and the host of How I Work. I was looking for like little openers, icebreakers of sorts to get us started, but then we got chatting about Elsenwick. What's the best and worst thing about living in Elsenwick?
Ooh, the best thing, I reckon, for the first time in my life, I know my neighbors and I say hi to them and I text message them. Yeah, right. And like, what is better than that? I've never experienced that before in my life. What is the worst thing? I've got an 8-month old puppy and she's a bit anxious around other dogs. So there's a couple of houses that have really scary dog sounds coming from them, and Luna gets very upset when we walk past. That would be the worst thing about Elsenwick.
Luna, great name. What breed?
She's a toy cavoodle, but she doesn't look like a cavoodle because she's apparently this niche type of cavoodle that's got straight hair. So I think she looks like a Disney dog. Like if someone were to draw a cartoon of a dog, that's what Luna looks like. She doesn't look like a cavoodle. She's confusing.
We've got two friends. We sort of babysat their dogs, I guess you could say. They went to Malaysia to get married and do the old tea ceremony for the Chinese side of the family. And they have two toy cavoodles, but one is like a real cavoodle. As in, it's the size of a standard cavoodle. But then the other one is literally like a toy, and it's bizarre. It's bizarre how they all come out quite different. Like, there's no perfect way of doing it.
I know.
It's pulling back my memory to that. Now, speaking of memories, what is your earliest childhood memory, do you think?
I find it really hard to know this for sure because sometimes I'll look at photos of when I was really young and I'll confuse that photo, like a photo that I might have seen many times, with that being an actual memory. So if we're classifying that as things that I potentially remember as opposed to have just looked at in a photo and think I remember, then I reckon when I was 3 or 4 years old, my parents took me to Disneyland and we got to have breakfast with the characters. So if you've never been to Disneyland before, all the Disneylands have this thing where they'll have a restaurant and adults will dress up as famous Disney characters and they'll float around all of the tables and you get to have your photo taken with them. And I just thought that was the best thing ever.
Yeah, right. And how old do you think you were?
So I think I was 3 or 4. Yeah, around about that age.
Wow. Were you like a big Disney fan growing up?
I think I must have been, because I was very, like, I've been to Disneyland and Disney World several times as a child and also as an adult. And I do like a lot of their content. Yes.
do you have a Disney subscription or a favorite? Like, what's the one that you keep coming back to in terms of movies?
Oh, well, you see, then I'd have to go with Pixar, given that that's
okay,
like Disney now. I would say the movie Up.
Oh, brilliant.
Have you seen? Oh, yeah. God, it makes me cry. Yeah. It's just so beautiful.
The opening sequence on Up is like just, it's a piece of art. No lines whatsoever. If you haven't seen Up, then I don't know what's wrong with you. What did you think you were going to be when you were a kid?
Well, when I was younger, let's say primary school years, I had quite creative ambitions. So I went through a period where I wanted to be a dress designer and dressmaker. So when I was about 11 or 12, I ended up doing an advanced dressmaking course at Spotlight.
Wow.
Here in Melbourne. And I've still got the masterpiece, like, which was kind of like the crescendo of this advanced dressmaking course, where you made a blazer with lining, which is very technically quite a hard thing to do, a lined blazer. Like, it's not like just making a t-shirt where technically there's two pieces and then you sew them together and you hem it. So I've still got that blazer. Like, wow. I never wear it. It's this repulsive beige linen blazer that I can't part with it because it was such an achievement. So I definitely wanted to do that. I definitely was very, very into sort of like creative things like acting and writing. But when I was a teenager and I started to get a little bit more realistic about the world, my mum's a clinical psychologist and we would talk a lot about her work, and she described herself as a detective of the mind. And
wow.
I thought, wow, that's what a really cool thing to do. And so I was pretty sure I would say my middle teenage years that I wanted to be a psychologist, and so much so that I also did want to audition for acting school, like NIDA and VCA, which are a couple of the big ones here in Australia. But and they were equal wants, like psychology and acting, but my parents weren't super keen on me becoming an actor. And so they said, we'll make a deal with you, like go and enroll in a Bachelor of Arts and do a psych major. And you can also do a theatre studies major as well. And if at the end of your three-year bachelor, you still want to be an actor, then we will support you in auditioning to acting school. And also I later found out many, many years later that they had told my dentist, so I'm very anal about oral hygiene, and I had the same dentist for, about 30 years or something like that, and I really adored him. And he told me one day when I was about 18 and he was doing like a checkup on my teeth, we got to talking about some of his clients that were actors, and he told me sometimes they can't afford dental work because it's really hard to make a living as an actor. And that kind of shocked me, the idea of not being able to afford dental work. But it turns out that my parents had put him up to saying that.
No way.
And tried to dissuade me from becoming an actor. Can you believe it?
Wow.
Yeah.
When how long after did you find that out?
Oh, like maybe 20 years later.
Whoa.
Like a long time later. So anyway, I went into psychology, did my drama major as well. And then I figured out, because I was doing like a bit of acting work on the side, I figured out that I didn't want to be in an industry where decisions were largely based on what I looked like, and therefore I didn't have a whole lot of control over my trajectory in that career. So I abandoned the idea of becoming an actor. I fully embraced psychology to the point where during my postgrad, during my honours and during my doctorate, I started doing a lot of songwriting. I was a singer, songwriter, guitarist. And because and we can go into this story if you want, I ended up getting offered a international record deal. But then, after working sort of with the label for about a year, they're like, you're going to have to be on tour for 11 months of every year. And it dawned on me that I would have to give up my dreams of becoming a psychologist if I wanted to become a professional musician. And so I said goodbye, I walked away from the record deal and, doubled down on psychology. That's how nerdy I am.
What type of music? What genre?
Well, Jordan, I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if this will mean anything 32. To you. 32. Okay, I'm 44. So I don't know if you remember Alanis Morissette from the 90s and Frente from the 90s.
Yeah.
Accidentally Kelly Street. So I would say, if you were to merge those two together and they created a love child, that would probably be what my music was like.
Okay, so sort of like a folk pop genre.
Yeah, exactly. My ex-husband would describe it as lonely girl music. isn't that the
beast? I know.
Yes.
That's so funny. Yeah, it's that is like as Triple J as you, like that is, you know how everyone's back into the 90s now?
Mm-hmm,
like that is the genre that everyone's into.
It totally is. You know what? I was even, I don't normally work Fridays, and not as my team because we do the 4-day week. But I actually had a couple of teammates over at my house this morning because we had this big mail out to do. And I'm like, what music do you guys want to listen to? And we all decided we should listen to some 90s while we worked. And that was very fun.
That is amazing. Mm. So were both your parents psychologists or just your mum?
Just my mum. So my mum was a psychologist. Dad was an engineer and computer programmer.
Wow. Okay. Mm. Yeah. So you doing the arts would have been very hard for them to understand. My parents' Greek background, they held trades and created a business. And so they were just like, you have to become a professional. But there was just no option in it. I did an accounting and finance degree, straight into like a mid-tier accounting firm. I think I lasted maybe 3 months and then I was done with it. And that's when I started getting into sort of like marketing and advertising. Like it started with sales, but you know, it was in that direction. So before you started Inventium, you had a lot of different roles. It looks like you were lecturing, took up a job in Adland, so at Leo Burnett as senior strategist, consumer psychologist. What do you think was, I guess there's two questions that I had to ask around the psychology component is, what is it that you think about your personality suits this domain? And then secondly, what was that insight that you took away from that time in the corporate world before you started your own business?
So let me answer the psychology thing first. I think I would say I'm pretty empathic and I get a lot of joy from helping people. And I wanted to be in a profession where helping people and helping them do better or be better or feel better was core to my job. So that was important. Yep. But also, particularly in advertising, I would say, which was represented 5 years or so of my professional career. I've always been very curious about like why people do the things that they do. And working as a consumer psychologist, I mean, that was really fun because my job was to understand human behavior and why people did the things that they did. But I mean, the sort of sticking point for me and why I ended up leaving the industry was because of the desire also to help people. And I felt like I didn't want to be using my psychology powers in inverted commas to help people just buy more chocolate bars. That didn't feel super noble.
Well, when was that moment where you had that feeling?
Well, funnily enough, before I accepted my first job in advertising, which was at a big Melbourne agency, I just finished reading No Logo by Naomi Klein, which was basically an anti-brand, anti-capitalism kind of book. And I was actually quite, I guess like quite anti-advertising then. But then this opportunity came up and I thought, oh, like intellectually, this sounds so interesting and maybe I can make change from the inside. And so I sort of went into it and I loved my job. I loved my work. I just found it so interesting and so much fun. And I worked with great people. But then after 5 years, I remember sort of for the last few months that I was at Leo Burnett that you mentioned, I was getting to that point where on Sunday night, I'd start to feel that feeling of dread that it's like, oh God, it's Monday morning tomorrow. And I hadn't experienced that when I was working in advertising. And so when I started to, I'm like, I've hit my use by date. I need to move on. And so I gave my boss at the time, who was Todd Sampson, who's gone on to do lots of interesting things. I gave him 3 months notice and I said, you know, Todd, I'll be out of here in 3 months so that you can plan around me. Cause I was in a role that was quite hard to recruit for and I wanted to do the right thing by him. But I had no idea what I was going to do.
So when did you know that the pivot was towards organizational psychology?
Well, that was what I trained as. And so in the world of psychology, consumer psychology sits under the umbrella of organizational psychology.
Really?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Wow. So if you look at like the different schools of psychology or the different psychology bodies, consumer psych fits within the under the org psych umbrella, which is I guess like it kind of makes sense because it's not going to fit within clinical or counselling or sport or educational. So that's where it sits.
Well, just on that, that makes sense as to why, like if that's not considered its own domain, like why all this newness of cognitive biases and behavioural science is so mind-blowing or evidence-based marketing, let's call it, which has sort of come out from your Ehrenberg Institutes of the World. I wonder if part of it is just a naivety and like, because I would assume that consumer psychology would be its own domain and there would be schools for that at different universities, like at your big, you know, 6 universities here in Australia. So it's really fascinating to hear that.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I mean, I don't know how much has changed in the last decade, but certainly when I was studying, there were no postgrad consumer psych options. When I last looked, because I often get people emailing me who are interested in a career in psychology. There wasn't really much in Australia. There's not that much globally, but I don't know what it looks like now. But yeah, it does. It fits within org psych. Like a lot of org psych courses would have a subject around consumer psychology.
Yeah, which they like the overarching thing is industrial and organizational psychology, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Okay. So you basically did your postgrad in that. Where, like, I'm just trying to work out how did Inventium come to be? Was it just like you're at the end of the 3 months and you're like, shit, I need money. This is what I studied. I know a few clients that like mold that for me. Because as an example, when we started our business and people asked, how did you get into this? A lot of it was someone asked us to do something at the time.
Okay. So it was more deliberate than that. So what happened was over that 3 month period, I knew I wanted to go back to my org psych roots. I knew I wanted to be helping people in a meaningful way. And I knew I wanted to be helping people get better and feel better about work because, you know, we spend like a third of our waking hours at work as adults. Mm. And I thought if I could impact that time positively, that would feel like time well spent in terms of my career. So I interviewed for a bunch of different jobs and I couldn't find anywhere that I like where I really loved the culture and I really liked the IP or the intellectual property that I'd be, you know, getting to play with every day. I did find one job though that I desperately wanted. And this was a job that I had no idea was even a thing. And it was an innovation consultant role at a big global innovation consultancy who shall remain nameless. And a good mate of mine worked there and she loved it. And she said, they're hiring, like, why don't you apply? And I thought, oh, brilliant. This is my dream job. It was all about helping people, you know, be more creative and drive innovation. And you know, really interesting companies. And I thought, this sounds perfect. And I got right through to like the final stage and that involved me having to come in and design and run a workshop for a large part of their team. And I woke up on the morning of having to do this workshop and I had the flu and I get colds and stuff. I can't think of the last time I've had the flu, but I had the flu. Like I was sweating like crazy. I had a fever. But I just thought like the show must go on. So I will just pretend that I'm absolutely fine. And I went in and I did the workshop. And I remember I taught people a magic trick and I got everyone, including me, wearing those cheap plastic sparkly hats that you can pick up from a $2 shop. And I don't know if like you can picture that. So I had one of those, like the top hats. Yeah, exactly. Because I thought that'll kind of be fun and get us all in the mood. And so I did the workshop and I remember leaving the building and I took off my plastic top hat and my hair was drenched. Like how much of a fever I had. I was like disgusting. And could you imagine doing that now in the world of COVID, like letting someone in who had like the flu and a fever? Anyway, this was pre-COVID, obviously. So did that, got a call the next day and the woman's like, look, thanks for coming in and running the workshop, but we're not going to put you through? And like, I was devastated. And I'm like, why? And she said, we just didn't feel like you had enough energy. And I said, oh, I can explain. I have the flu, but I didn't want to cancel. I said, is there any way that I could get a second chance? And she said, we don't normally give second chances, but under the circumstances, let me check. So she got back to me the following day and she said, okay, we're going to make an exception because you had the flu. You can come in, but you have to train us in something else. You have to design a whole new workshop. And you know, we can do that in a couple of weeks. So I went back in and with this new workshop, a couple of weeks later, didn't have the flu. I was feeling healthy. I was feeling good. Delivered the workshop, thought I did a good job, and got a call the next day. And she said, yeah, we're still not going to put you through. And I said, like, did I not have enough energy still? And she said, no, your energy was fine. And she said, but, you know, a couple of people just didn't find you very engaging. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like what shocking feedback to receive. Because like, how do you become more engaging? It's like, become more charming, please. Yeah. I hung up the phone and I just burst into tears because I thought this is the only job out of all the jobs I've looked at that is remotely close to what I want to do. Like it was literally my dream job and I was rejected from it. And a couple of my friends said, well, why don't you just do your own company? And at the time I was in my late 20s and I'm like, what do I know? Like no one's going to trust me. It wasn't like it is today where it's just really normal to start a business in your 20s as a woman as well. It was just like, there weren't any women that I knew that had started a business in their 20s. And literally it was the plan B. I thought, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. I literally thought, fuck it. Like I'll do this for 6 months. I will start my own consultancy. I will create a consultancy that is basically like the consultancy that rejected me and I'll see how it goes. I had plenty of savings. I didn't have a mortgage or kids or anything like that at the time. And, but I'd see what happened. And that was Inventium. Wow. And here we are 15 years later. And as an addendum to that story, the Sydney office of this big global innovation consultancy ended up closing 1 year later.
Wow.
Yeah.
So who was your first client?
Well, my first three clients were all clients that I had from my advertising agency. Uh-huh. And because I was working in a different industry, there were no issues with like the, you know, non-compete clause that you get in employment contracts. So I remember NRMA, Diageo, a big alcoholic beverages company, and Energy Australia, I want to say, was my third client. They all came on board literally from day one. So we were cash flow positive from day one.
Wow.
And I remember in the first year, revenue was pretty much exactly the same as the salary that I was making in advertising.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So when you look at what you do, like with your clients and how you, because I know what it's like when you're in a service business, is you're trying to imprint the knowledge that you have in your head to those clients specific to their situation, right? And you get better and better over time at developing these principles, but also explaining them to people. So I'm just curious, you know, everyone loves a soundbite, but probably rarely ask you in interviews around what are your core principles for optimizing and innovating in the workplace. So when you, in your mind, when you're going to a new customer, what's like the Gary groundwork that you explain to them?
Well, with innovation, and I should add, like everything that we do at Inventium is based on science. So I only employ science geeks, and you know, we read research papers for fun. And so every tool, strategy, framework that we've developed at Inventium is evidence-based, which kind of in a way makes it easier to develop stuff because you're looking at what's been scientifically proven to work in academic journals. And then, you know, I think the sort of the skill that we bring to what we do is going, how do we make complex science really simple and practical for organizations and people to apply. So with innovation, for example, which historically is where we've done a lot of work, we developed, it's like a maturity model in terms of what do you need to do as an organization to become more innovative? And that framework then turned into what underpins one of the big projects that we do with the Australian Financial Review, where we run the most innovative companies list. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, do you still do best places to work as well?
We do. So that's a newer list for us. So we started that a couple of years ago during the pandemic. So yeah, we do that with the AFR as well, which is, you know, it's just like super interesting getting to look inside hundreds of workplaces and go, what are you doing to create a great place to work?
Yeah, well, that was like, I had a selfish question in there around more for you around growing a business in a services industry. I mean, like probably Adam Ferrier of Thinkabell, you've hired a CEO to run the day-to-day of Inventium. There's obviously elements of Inventium that have made it succeed. For example, the fact that you just specialize in this area would be a major component. At an early stage when people were only looking at this, I think there's a lot of brand value clearly in the AFR work that you do. Then there's clientless proof of work as well. What do you think in hindsight in the last decade has been the most important thing for you to do as a founder?
It's such a good question and it's hard to get it down to one thing. I would say, as a founder, I think knowing when the right time to not be CEO was very important because it freed me up to play to my strengths. Like, I think over the last 15 years, I've become a better leader. I think in the early years, I had little idea of what I was doing and was, you know, trying to do things intuitively, but, you know, I made some like massive mistakes and, you know, did some things that I look back on now and go, oh my God, I cringe with embarrassment about that. So I think that really freed me up not having to be responsible for running the business, and I don't really do much around the day-to-day in the business anymore. But I reckon, and it's kind of like this is, like, it's been a really positive thing, but it's also a kind of tricky thing as well, is that I focused a lot on thought leadership. And I remember in the early days of Inventium, I would just like, I loved speaking. And I knew that like I was quite a good speaker, even though this innovation agency said that I wasn't very engaging, damn them. But I knew that like audiences that I got, you know, good positive feedback. I seemed to be able to have a good impact on people when I spoke to people en masse. And so I basically just pimped myself out to any event that would have me that, you know, had my target market in the room, and was able to generate quite a lot of work through speaking. And then also deliberately doing quite a lot of thought leadership work in the media to like article writing and, you know, being interviewed for various things. And like lots of people would call us up and go, oh, I, you know, saw you talking about such and such here, like in the Financial Review, or I heard you on ABC talking about this or whatever. So that was really good. And now I would say with the podcast, How I Work, which I've hosted for 4 years now, it's been interesting because in the early days of doing the podcast, you know, people would listen and it had quite good downloads, but it didn't drive a lot of new inquiries to Inventium. But I reckon something happened, and I don't know what, but it's like it reached this tipping point. And now I would say like every week we would either be getting a new inquiry for some work into Inventium, or I would be having a sales conversation with someone that was a fan of How I Work.
Interesting.
So yeah, all that thought leadership stuff has been absolutely massive. But having said that, I mean, like if you're building a services company and you want to scale it, you don't really want dependencies on the founder. So it's kind of like a blessing and a curse, double-edged sword, I guess. I just try to go with it, but it's not without its problems.
So Just on the How I Work podcast, what do you think was, like, do you think it was a timing thing potentially with the tipping point? Do you think it was a certain guest?
I wish I could put it down to something, but I genuinely have no idea. Like, it's not like there was ever anything that happened that led to a massive step change in downloads. Like, there have been things that have led to growth in downloads, and it gradually increases. Now we're at over 3.5 million downloads. And so I guess, like, with that number, that's obviously not unique people that have listened. That's total downloads, but you kind of go, okay, I guess the podcast is reaching a lot of people, and some of those people have specific needs in their organization, and maybe they control a budget and they have listened to the show, and they trust that I know a bit about how to work better.
Yeah, it's always fascinating when that moment comes. I feel like we had that maybe 6 to 9 months ago, and maybe it was just the guess. It's hard to say. It is so hard to say, but there is that moment of crossover for sure.
Mm.
When you think about, now I am going to ask you about sound bites, workplace themes, the general, let's call it the macro situation right now, is that everyone has gone from working in the office to work from home. You can see that in so many different factors, from house prices to commercial property. We bought this office, this studio that we're in at the moment, late last year, because it was basically half price. Like, it was just absolutely ridiculous how much that was impacted. If you speak to most people, there's a sort of resentment of purely going back into the office. I feel like there's a before and after state of COVID, where people understand now that they don't always have to be there, particularly for knowledge-based workers. And then there's a general, I don't know what the supply-demand issue is right now. I don't know if it's because we've boomeranged back to life as it was immediately before COVID, and therefore demand has shot up exponentially because people are trying to do things that they couldn't do for 2 years, and therefore the demand is abnormal. Not just that we can't get staff, but there is clearly a staffing issue in a lot of different industries, particularly like consumer facing industries. Mm. What are the big things that you're observing at the moment that's like crystal clear in your head?
Well, one thing that's crystal clear is that I reckon unless you are offering an ultra flexible working environment in terms of not just where you work from, which is what everyone seems to default talking to, but when you work, like the hours that you work and how you work, like, you know, we have to be talking about output, not, you know, doing a 40-hour week now, surely. I think that that's absolutely huge. And look, I know at Inventium, we've tried all sorts of various things about making a great place to work. And certainly one of my goals of starting a business, as well as doing great consulting work in the area that we work in, but was also to create the best workplace that anyone that ever works at Inventium has ever worked before. That has been a constant goal. I haven't always achieved that, haven't always been successful with that. But I would say right now, with the team that we have, 11 of us, I reckon that would be true for everyone in the team, that this is the best place that they've ever worked. And I reckon moving to the 4-day week, which is where we pay people a full-time salary, people work for normal length days, so 80% of the time, for 100% output. So the expectation is that they will produce the output that they would produce if they were a full-timer. That has been the most game-changing thing that we've done. Like, just the balance that brings, and the impact that has on people's mental health and physical health as well, I would say has been better than anything else that we've done. And we've done some we've done some crazy stuff. Like, we had unlimited paid leave for 3.5 years, for example, but that was nothing compared to the impact of the 4-day week, I would say.
Interesting. And what else are the other components that you think have made the most sense? Like, I agree with the 4-day work week thing is very interesting. A lot of people talk about it at the moment.
Mm.
But is there something else that's become crystal clear in the last few years?
Autonomy has got to be up there. We, for 5 or 6 years, we've run a holacracy, which is basically where you get rid of managers. So people manage themselves, essentially. So people will check in with our CEO on a quarterly basis, but people set their own goals. They know the company goals. They set their own goals so that everyone's ladders up to the company goals. People do a quarterly reflection where they'll be asked certain questions to reflect on the past quarter and the future quarter. They don't have a manager that they report to. They might have a leader that acts as a coach, but they're not a manager that reviews them. Everyone gives each other feedback. It's very much a peer feedback kind of environment for improvement. And so people have a lot of autonomy. And autonomy is a basic driver of motivation at work and in life. But I think some people, I feel like there's a lot of people that are just not suited to working at Inventium because it's almost like they've, it's like, I feel like some organizations kind of bash the confidence out of you because they micromanage you. And then you come to Inventium and it's like, hang on, I've got all this freedom. No, I need more direction.
They need the cookie cutter approach. Yeah. I had a mate, a very good friend of mine who worked at this company, Ibis World, which is sort of a data analytics company, but they're specific around industry. And so he'd come from one of the big telecom providers. Like, I think it was IINet.
Mm.
And he was so used to like SOPs and all that sort of stuff that like he would struggle in situations where basically there would be a manager who was sort of like a leader in that regard. They'd coach you, but you were sort of just on your own. And you were measured on how you were performing or your output. Mm. It wasn't the perfect situation for that because it was still, there was some old things in the way that they operated, but it was definitely one of the most likely places where I felt you had just complete freedom. Like, no questions asked about what you're doing if you've got the numbers, if that makes sense. So if you're doing the things right, the output components make sense and line up, then no one would really bother you. Which I found fascinating. But yeah, he really struggled with that.
Yeah.
Now, what percentage of the workforce do you think is like that? And is that personality or is that prior workplaces?
I would think that it's prior workplaces because if we look at, say, self-determination theory, which is one of the more popular theories of human motivation, it says that autonomy is one of three key drivers of human motivation. The other two are mastery and connection, human connection. So, yeah, I think it's experiences with other workplaces. Like, I feel like an Inventium, people either thrive, they love the working environment with so much flexibility and autonomy, or it makes them feel really, really uncomfortable. I do think that there's a lot of particularly big corporates that are kind of ruining people for places like Inventium.
Yeah, it's so weird. I just always assumed it was some element of personality as well. What do you think then are like the common traps that business owners, leaders are falling into when it comes to the way that they operate in the workplace?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, certainly micromanagement, terrible. certainly like from this research that SAP commissioned around curiosity called Capitalizing on Curiosity, they certainly found that managers who really encouraged curiosity in their teams, that was super important for engagement. And certainly through the work that we've done at Inventium, I mean, companies that value innovation and creativity and curiosity, they have far more engaged employees because, like, as humans, we want to be We want to be working on interesting problems and solving those and feeling a sense of challenge in what we do. So I think that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, I think managers that are really risk adverse are really killing people's motivation and engagement because they're like depriving them of the opportunities to explore and be curious.
Yeah. So explain this study to me, because that was how we got introduced, right? Is part of this study. And like one of the lines there was around the survey of these business leaders that SAP commissioned this piece by YouGov. There were some things in there that I was just like, I was perplexed by. Like, they found that leaders who strongly agree that their organization has a curious culture. So annual turnover growth of 20% on average over the last 12 months. So they were saying that relative to other turnover, that it was higher. Like, how did that come into this study and what were they trying to explain with that?
Yeah, look, I think it's something that we see in a lot of research where companies that do actively promote innovation and focus on innovation, particularly when times are tough, they will see those financial rewards at the other end. And certainly, like, I know that there's some research that looked at organizations during recessions, and they looked at companies that that kind of doubled down on innovation versus other companies that just kind of got a bit scared and just focused on survival. Certainly the ones that double down on innovation typically come out on top financially, mm-hmm. but also, you know, you can imagine, like, from an employee morale point of view as well. I think, you know, when you focus on curiosity and innovation and creativity and everything kind of within that realm, that is a very good and important thing for business.
Yeah, it was interesting to see how they map that onto, like, statistical analysis. They looked at, like, what curiosity would do to your average business. And I always love that you got to love the numbers, right? An extra 1.7 million or an additional 550,000 in annual turnover if you're a small business. Do you know how many organizations were surveyed in this, in the survey?
Yeah, that is a good question. I don't know the exact number.
Yeah, because it'd be fascinating. Like, we've been given a link to the report. It'll be in the show notes. People should go have a look at it. But I'm just always intrigued to know, like, how many people do they survey for this thing? What goes into it? Do you, when it comes to, like, the science of, like, research in organizational psychology, where do surveys fit into the sort of scope of peer-reviewed research? Like, I understand that this isn't a peer-reviewed thing. It's commissioned by a workplace. But do you find that this sort of stuff is really useful to you guys for guiding where research is going, or showing sort of maybe where businesses are playing catch up to where the research is?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I must say, I remember when I started working in advertising and I was involved in reading a lot of research that had been done, like, by other firms and doing my own research. I was kind of quite shocked at how shoddy a lot of research is. So I would say, certainly one of the things I look for, I mean, surveys in and of themselves are only as good as the items in the survey and the analysis of the data and also the sample size. And look, certainly with the SAP research, it was a big sample size where you could draw statistical significance. But where I think people create ineffective surveys is where the survey items are poorly constructed. Like, they might be leading, they might be putting a bit of bias into things. So, like, one of the things you learn in organizational psychology is how to create a good survey that actually measures what you're trying to measure. So it has high reliability. Sadly, I feel like it's so easy to create a survey because the software is out there, but a lot of people have never been trained into how to actually write good survey items.
And so how would that differ if someone does a survey versus does peer-reviewed research? What would be different about how that is done in the workplace. Cause I, you know, it's hard for me as a pleb to understand how like peer reviewed research is done for organizational psychology.
Yeah. And I'd say there's also quite a big difference in peer reviewed methodology as well, because within academia, you've got a hierarchy of journals. So you've kind of got like the top tier journals, you know, let's say in psychology, like Journal of Applied Psychology is one of the top ones. And it's really hard to get published in that journal because they're really picky about the methodology. Mm. Whereas like you've got still peer reviewed journals where the articles are being reviewed by peers in your industry, other people in academia typically, but it's easier to get into because they're not as sort of stringent around the methodology. So a very basic example, like if you're you know, trying to demonstrate some kind of you know, causality or behavior change, like you ideally want a control group and an experimental group. That would be like a, you know, basic methodology. It's kind of like A/B testing, you know, in the world of like startups and, you know, internet marketing-y sort of things. You know, ideally, the people running the experiment don't know what the hypotheses are. So they're blind to that and therefore can't influence the results just unconsciously. So there's sort of all sorts of things that are, that like when I'm reading a paper and trying to think about the methodology and whether it's a decent one or not, that are kind of going through my brain. And they're like a couple of things.
Okay. And just quickly, the journal that you recommend, if for any geeks listening, they want to read more about organizational psychology, it sounds like there's a journal specific to applied psych that would cover subgenres of org.
Yeah. So look, the Journal of Applied Psychology would be one of the top ones in organizational psychology. So that's, you know, that is behind a paywall.
Of course it is.
But yeah. I'm sure that there are websites where you can uncover that without paying. But sometimes you can just stumble upon these PDFs that have been uploaded onto the internet. But yeah, certainly you can have a look at like, you know, the table of contents and get a feel for the sorts of things that psychologists are interested in and researching.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, it's always super fascinating to read this stuff, I find personally, but yeah, that's so funny. All right. I'm wary of time. We've got to wrap pretty soon. So let's get into the rapid fire questions. What's in your fridge at home?
Lots of vegetables. So I'm a massive vegetable eater. Okay. And like to the point where a few years ago, I actually ended up paying someone $50 a week to cut up an entire week's worth of fruit and vegetables for myself and my daughter. Like literally between us, I reckon we'd eat 15 serves a day of fruit and vegetables, like mental. And lactose free dairy products are also in my fridge too.
Interesting. Do you have like a family background that sort of leans heavier on that food? Cause it's sort of a similar thing with like Greek culture. Yeah. Like I love veggies and I know the problem as well. Because I just do mass chop-ups and roasting of vegetables.
No, there's nothing in my family background that got me interested in vegetables other than me placing a strong value on my health. And I should add, my fridge also looks very nice because when I had COVID a couple of months ago, I fell into the black hole that is the Home Edit. I don't know if you've if you follow them on Instagram, they've got about 6 million followers and they basically, my daughter describes it as organizing things in rainbow colors, and that's a pretty apt description. So the fridge looks pretty as well.
Gotcha. The Home Edit. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Last question for you. What is the best purchase that you've made probably in the last 12 plus months under $200?
Definitely my electric blanket, which cost me $60. And I don't know why, as someone that lives in Melbourne, where it's very cold in winter, that I went so long without an electric blanket. My partner suggested getting one and I was like, oh, that seems like a novelty. But I just, oh my God, it makes getting into bed like just joyous. And $60.
Do you remember those as a kid though?
Like, yeah, I do. I had an electric blanket as a kid and I don't know why.
Yeah, why, what happened there?
One. I don't know.
Really odd. Like I remember like people being paranoid about like electrical faults and it catching on fire. That was like a real thing.
Oh yeah, that was totally a thing. Yeah.
Maybe it was that. I don't know. But I remember my in-laws said the other week, because they've bought a place up on the in Port Douglas. They live there maybe 2 months, 3 months of the year now. And they were driving up straight through the middle of Australia. It was quite cold where they were. I can't remember what town it was, but the motel had electric blankets. And it's good because they're cheaper and they probably emit just a little bit less than having your heating on.
Yeah.
And probably better for your skin as well.
I would say so. Yeah. So, I just love mine. So much joy in that blanket.
Amantha, thank you so much for doing this. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, thank you for asking. They can find me if you type Amantha, which is like Samantha without the S, into a search engine, and maybe add my surname Imba, which is like Timber without the T. You will find me on through Inventium's website at amantha.com, which is my own website, and on social media. And you can also check out my new book, Timewise, where I talk about a bunch of habits, hacks and strategies that the world's most successful people use their time more wisely, which are all things that I have learnt from hosting the How I Work podcast.
And where is the book going to be available?
Anywhere where you buy a book, you will be able to get Timewise, and it's available for pre-order now. So if you just search Timewise into Amazon or Booktopia or wherever you buy books, you will find it.
Okay, cool. So we can get it on Amazon and all that. Amazing.
Sure can. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much, Jordan. This has been so fun.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe, and of course, like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. For behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's at uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.